Night by Walter de la Mare. The sun descending in the west, the evening star does shine. The twilight deepens, the last faint spectral colours in the west vanish away. Now the day is over, night is drawing nigh. Shadows of the evening steal across the sky. Now the darkness gathers, stars begin to peep, birds and beasts and flowers soon will be asleep. With that darkness, those stars and that sleep, we are nowadays becoming less and less familiar. Even if by good fortune we are neither city bred nor city pent, but live in the country. The tolling curfew, if it were still audible over some wide-watered shore, swinging slow with sullen roar, would, as heretofore, leave the world to darkness. But we ourselves, unless perhaps we are in love, or grief, or despair, or wish to meditate, hasten to switch on our electric bulbs. Paraffin lamps, even the Victorian gas jet, until it dismally hooded itself with a mantle, were a less abrupt alternative to the Victorian gloaming. And to resort to candles even for a few hours is to realize what an aid their gentle light can be to quiet of mind and quiet talk, let alone the beauty thus conferred on quiet face and musing eye. And summer or winter, candles are even a kind of company. Darkness itself nowadays is steadily narrowing in for most of us to being merely the domain of sleep, which blessedly has a darkness solely its own. We flood not only both living room and bedroom with a glare rather than with light, but also our cities, towns, high roads, and even our villages and lanes. Until the advent of the motor car, it is true, the magic, fantastic, theatrical, or serene of a country road skirting woodland or arched over with forest trees and illuminated by this vibrant glare was undiscovered. But a Guy Fawkes bonfire achieves a similar witchery and at less expense of spirit to the solitary wayfarer. As for London, one needs to be alone at night in the silent and deserted heart of the city to realize the overwhelming odds nowadays against those who plan some evil. I can recall no more bizarre solitude than that of the musty four-wheeler in which, to the clop of its horse's shoes, I traversed some years ago in the small hours an exotically illuminated Cheapside. And not another spectre, not so much as a vagrant cat in sight. So complete, whatever the advantage may be, is our present slavery to the lamp, that for most of us it is something of an adventure to go upstairs in the dark, or to enjoy that curious fellowship with ourselves incident to undressing in it. To be naked in the dark is to be naked, myself and no other. But at any rate, unashamed. To sit alone in it and to remain for the time being as far as possible at peace may bring not only refreshment to the spirit, but even be tinged with romance. Like Thomas Hood's roses and lily cups, our minds and our moods in differing degree are made of light or of darkness. They respond then, given the opportunity, to every change of light. A house in the small hours with electricity laid on is a fortress. Nimble sentries are instantly ready on its battlements. A wind-ridden or fog-bound house of many rooms, with not a tan sticker or stub of tallow to its name, may seem, if there is still any childhood left in us, to be helplessly listening for the others, either from without or from within. But how else prove that there are others? A little experience will answer that question quite as well as any medium. It was to earthly night, the dumb hour clothed in black, that the three sons of Usher's Well returned from the gates of paradise, and Sheridan Le Fanu, as every adept of the powers of the air must be, was as familiar with the dark as with his own hands. We dance attendance on daylight by instinct and confirmed habit. We should make an assignation with the night. For years, I have intended to enjoy a spell of life which would familiarize me with the complete daily allowance of 24 hours in all their guises. Sunrise to sunrise, by merely shifting, say, half an hour forward, my habitual period of repose. Alas, like so many others, this charming project still remains a mere project. Our minds, Alice Meynell has said, our senses, our sensibilities are profoundly affected by the hours of darkness, although, as with the changes of the seasons, spring as opposed to autumn, as with the weather and our physical well-being, we may be only vaguely aware of it. The fancy, the fantasy is then more sharply on the qui vive, restless, alert. Our chief and most active spy on actuality, the eye, is now on a precarious footing. The listener within may at any moment be compelled to supersede the sighted. Protracted night work, moreover, not only, it has been ascertained, affects the poise of the mind, but the action of the heart and the health. The door of the unconscious, or of the conscious, edges open, stands less narrowly ajar. And the solemn tide of darkness ebbing and flowing, the dusk of midsummer midnight, the small black hours of winter, is at least as mysterious as the tides of the seven seas. By preference or habit, we curtain out the dark, and unless illness compels it, we seldom have set intent watch out its hours, and so taste to the full its solitude, strangeness, and emptiness. How strange at night to wake and watch while others sleep, till sight and hearing ache for objects that may keep the awful inner sense unroused, lest it should mark the life that haunts the emptiness and horror of the dark. No close acquaintance with it is practicable by means of mere chance glimpses. We must set apart a certain hour, and again keep quiet watch from open window, from field or hill or garden, even if over only so brief a period as a lunar month. And of one thing we may be certain, the mistress we are wooing will not cheat us of our tryst. The world without appears to have been lulled into a tense reverie of attention, or to have withdrawn itself into its own private affairs. We begin to learn what weather means to the shepherd and the sailor, or heavy rain may be falling, its fragrant sigh overwhelming the silence under a dense canopy of cloud. There is a cold, sweet freshness in the late summer air, as if the mother of us all were giving suck to her Benjamin, sitting quietly in her chair. Or, the rain over, the leaden minute drops from leaf to leaf sharpen the quietude. Arrest the listener behind the ear. At night, too, the recurrent onset and lulling of the wind is less like a mere formless noise than the accents of a voice roaming through a world countless centuries before the spirit of man spurred its dust. Night by night, little by little, the stars and the planets creep up towards their zenith. As yet hidden constellations begin to thrust their horns above the horizon line, we realize how delicate are the degrees of dusk and darkness between the Stygian and even the starlit. And if we stay still, passive and receptive, the stars themselves begin to shake their colors in the sky, as if they were endeavoring to transmit us an urgent message in some celestial Morse code of their own. Make friends with them. They will not fail us. Each gigantic tree wears a gravity and solemnity as of Keats's forest senators. Every flitting moth becomes a private visitor with an unspoken message. Every owl squeak is a half-secret countersign, and every drift of open grass or road or meadow becomes at length as familiar as was the forest of Arden to Titania, to her lovely Indian boy, and her elves. At the same time, we find ourselves straying into far less familiar regions than usual of the mind, an emanation far within of the fathomless and boundless deep may awake, and not always to recall our griefs, our follies, our ruined loves, or our sins. A tedious, restless daybreak does that best. The imagination bestirs itself in the dark. The serpent sloughs its daily skin, and perhaps because the night actually attracts less kindly phantom fauna than the day, evil and disaster are associated with darkness, dark thoughts, a darkened outlook, dark deeds, the night of the soul. The imaginative writers have given the sharpest edge to the word. What is called realism is usually a record of life at a low pitch and ebb, viewed in the sunless light of day, so often a drab waste of grey and white, and an east wind blowing. But imaginative evil, either in thought or act or art, is an evil that is rare, and maybe almost past endurance. There is an evil dream in Dostoevsky. There are drawings of Goya's, and this, like the funguses, flourishes in the dark. By an act of grace, we have been given eyelids, silent, untiring twin sisters, which are not only an exquisite means of expression to those strange, lovely and eloquent, or strange and equally repellent marvels of life, light, color and movement that gaze out from beneath them. They are also a priceless refuge and release from the distractions and fatigue of the world without. Sight indeed unlike touch and smell, is not a local sensibility. It seems to flood one's whole being with the lustrous scene it bestows. Let there be light. And we ourselves are light. But since safety first, whatever its danger as maxim is a paramount instinct, we cannot at will, alas, except when the mind is so intent that not even a clap of thunder may win admittance, refuse to hear. Nonetheless, how seldom in the waking day do we deliberately close a while our eyes, and thus regain for the time being the quiet and hospitable vestibule of the mind. This is because, perhaps, attention tends then to begin to waver, because the signpost in that peculiar small darkness, fenced off more densely than was Robinson Crusoe's stockade from actuality, points vaguely out to sleep. We seldom, even in reverie indeed, shut our eyes, since that way again lies night dream. The precarious authority and power of direction which we have over our faculties slips away, and we, presently after, become less responsible for what may chance to us, like Hansel and Gretel in the darkening wood. Nor indeed in our familiar England is night frequently synonymous with pitch darkness. When cloud is scattered and not dense, the light rained faintly down upon us from the infinitely remote stars resembles a lucent dust in the air. And surely, one of the happiest of our earthly accidents, there is the moon, the lovely moon des Anglois.